It's time for the Financial Cafe, airing every Saturday morning at 9 a.m. on 88.7 WSIE The Sound. Today's show is underwritten by The Chef Shop, your hometown kitchen accessory store, where a good cup of coffee starts every day right. The views expressed on the Financial Cafe are those of the hosts and do not represent the views of Southern Illinois University Edwardsville, the SIU Board of Trustees, or WSIE Radio. Securities offered through Nickel Investors Corporation at No. 1 Executive Park, Granite City, Illinois, member FINRA and SIPC.
If I had $1 million.
And now, welcome to the Financial Cafe and our hosts, Larry Lexo and John Graney.
Good morning, John Graney.
Good morning, Larry Lexo. How are we doing today?
We're doing wonderful. How about you?
Living the dream, as usual.
As usual. Well, it's a good dream anyway.
Today's a good dream. Today's not bad.
We have a guest joining us.
I see that. That chair has become quite popular.
It's a good thing. Mr. Pat Mathis, welcome this morning.
Morning, Larry.
Glad you could join us from Mathis, Marathon, and Richter. Pat and I, we were talking about that this morning earlier. We've known one another since the 90s, at least. When we were co-sponsors of the Family Business of the Year Awards, which were supported by the business department here at Southern Illinois University in Edwardsville. We had some good times, had some great businesses that were awarded. In fact, one of them, several of them actually had national recognition from the program. So, you know, out supporting the small business and anyone else that we can find.
Absolutely.
And we were in grade school then, too, John.
Yeah, close, yeah.
And I'm not buying that.
Good start.
That's usually what I make fun of Larry about, and we have fun with that.
You do enough of your own.
I know. So, in the market.
What's the market doing, John?
It's up. Scarily. It is up. I don't, as we have talked about before, this is going to be the year of competing forces. And right now, the enthusiasm with Trump and his administration and what he's trying to do has driven the market, I would say, scare, as I mentioned. It makes me nervous that it has gone up so quickly, so much, and it's all based on hype. It's based on what will happen. We haven't seen any specifics with regards to the tax reform that he's supposed to provide, as well as some of his other initiatives. But because he favors businesses, that has driven the market up, and it just makes me a little bit nervous. We saw this, as they call it, a bubble. We've seen this before. So, folks, hang on. You will probably see a drop. But at the end of the four-year period, I think we will see a stronger economy because of his policies and how that will work. But what I wanted to talk about.
What did you want to talk about, John?
Oh, fake news, Larry. I am a victim. Well, I can't say you because I was the one that presented the story a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, let's get it right.
Fake news. You said, I don't buy it. I said, I don't understand it. Folks, we talked about an article that came out in Bloomberg, which was a reputable name, the name Bloomberg. It's kind of up there with Microsoft and Morningstar and things like that. Some credibility to it. But it turns out Nevin Adams from Napa proved the article wrong. And in the article, it said that two-thirds of people are not contributing to their 401k plan.
And I think I commented at the time that was not evident in the plans that we work with.
Right. We did highlight the fact that, you know, we hadn't seen that. Well, it turns out when you dig in, as he did, there are some crazy calculations. The black box was skewed towards reporting it that people weren't saving. For whatever reason, a narrative drove the article as opposed to facts. So,
not coming from the government.
Well, I'm not going to go there. I don't want that soapbox yet. But eligibility was one of them. It talked about Whether you were eligible to participate in the plan or not, you were included in that number.
Of course.
It also excluded employer contributions. So maybe you're not participating, but money is going into the plan because of the employer, whether it's a profit sharing or some other form of contribution. You were considered a full-time employee by the definition of if your income was over $3,770.
No, that's a good number.
So if you're making $4,000 a year, you're considered a full-time employee. And I'm sorry, but if you're making $4,000 a year, you're not contributing to a plan. So that was in there. If you're already a retiree and you were working and you didn't check that little box on your W-2 that says I was contributing to a 401k plan, you were included. What about if you work for two different companies, two different employers? Maybe you're contributing on the one end, but the other company you're not, you were included in that number.
So it was bogus.
And a defined benefit plan. If you worked for a company that didn't offer 401k, but they offered a defined benefit plan, again, you were included in that number. So he went through, that's just six of the bigger items, line items that he went through to explain why that number appeared so high. And in his research, which came from the Employee Benefit Research Institute, that between 65 and 75% of people that are eligible to participate in a plan are actually contributing to a 401k plan, which ties in exactly to the number that you quoted when we first talked about this story.
Yeah, if we can't get up to that 80% number in terms of participation, then we're generally doing something wrong because it's no longer a question of whether or not you participate in your own retirement planning and putting money away. Because if you don't, then there's going to be a problem down the road because nobody else is going to do it for you.
Can't borrow money to retire. But so we are victims of fake news. It's not just Donald Trump.
Imagine that. How much more fake news is out there? Well, we won't even talk about the cost of living index.
I'm not going to get into government statistics. We have harped on that. And I want to have a happy day, Larry.
Okay, happy day. Well, for a happy day, we're going to thank the Chef Shop, who is our underwriter for this portion of the show. Both Scott and Nancy, and I do mention in most of the time that Scott was a graduate of the Mass Communications Department here at SIU, spent his career with AT&T, retired, and is now back working again. Nancy bought out the Chef Shop from Vicki Primrose a number of years ago, as she shared with us in her interview a few weeks ago, and have really expanded into multiple segments out there in the Schnucks Plaza next to Target. And for those of you who haven't been out there taking a look at all of the popcorn venues, I think she said they had 80 different popcorns that you can purchase in multiple sizes, all of the fudge,
yummy
candy.
Flavors.
And, of course,
the fudge is ridiculous.
You can't get out of there without fudge. And then the coffees, which we have reviewed pretty much all of the coffees at least once, and many of them twice, because we do sample those throughout the show. Don't tell anybody, though. Yeah, coffee is excellent. So stop by, see the Chef Shop. Spend a little time in there, especially if you have a gift coming up, whether it's a graduation, birthday, anniversary, whatever it happens to be. If you don't know what to get them, just go out and see Nancy or one of the other folks in there, and I guarantee you, you will come out with something that that they will like.
And mention that you heard about them on the show, and there is a free gift. We have a goodie box over there full of gifts, except for coffee mugs. They are now out of the coffee mugs, which we will be replacing here shortly. But there are other gifts in that box that they will give you if you say, I heard about you on the Financial Cafe.
So be sure and go in, mention the Financial Cafe, and you can have a free T-shirt. I think there still are a few T-shirts when I talked to Lisa out there the other day. But the coffee mugs are gone, but we have ordered new ones. Actually, we're getting thermal mugs now, so it'll handle your coffee, your hot and your cold beverages. So those will be coming whenever they come in the next couple of weeks. So if you go in there and they don't have them yet, be sure and stop back by and visit with them. So again, thanks to the Chef Shop for sponsoring us as an underwriter for the show, as well as Steve Jankowski and WSIE-FM, The Sound, and the beautiful campus of Southern Illinois University. So our topic for the month is unexpected events. I know last week we visited with Michelle Laws, who helps people coordinate their financial information in the event of divorce. And of course, divorce is one of those extremes that many people may be surprised with, some may not, but planning certainly is an area that comes into play there.
I mean, it's a niche market, if you will, but I mean, the application of it is absolutely incredible to be able to help people that may not have a financial background consolidate, pull everything together, run the numbers, run the estimates to make sure that when if you do go through a divorce, that it is fair and balanced for both parties, and separate the emotion from the financial decision, which is always difficult. And as we have always said, that any financial decision based on emotion is probably going to be wrong.
It probably is, and in most cases is wrong. And we talk about the financial plan. Again, I mention it pretty much every show. Everyone needs a plan. It needs to be in writing. You have to have specific time frames, specific objectives. You have to implement the plan. That's where a lot of people fall down. They go through the planning process, and they never do anything about it.
Right.
It's not going to work if you don't act on it. And the last and probably equally important step is to review it periodically. We've stated earlier this year, if you normally review your plan annually, do it twice this year because of the volatility in the market and what's going on. Have a well-diversified allocation of your portfolio and, you know, be prepared for the unexpected. So part of that unexpected preparation ties into our visit with Pat today in talking about what are some of the basic things that an individual, family or individual, need to have in place just in the event that the unexpected happens.
Yes, thank you, Larry. I think you touched on the right term there when you said planning. I really think that estate planning is more than just a will. It's about planning for what happens in the event that you pass away, your wife dies, your husband dies, a child dies. What's really going to happen beyond just what's in that will? And when we talk with clients, we try to get them to focus on gathering their information together about their home, their bank accounts, CDs, their investment accounts, if they have IRAs, if they have 401ks, life insurance, all of those things that are out there that are part of their financial life become part of their estate planning life if they're going to do it right. We try to have them come to us with that information and incorporate it into their planning. Whether they're dealing with a large estate or a small estate, those are all real issues. So, for instance, a person may have a very simple will that says that I leave my everything I own to my husband or my wife, and if I'm not living, then to my children. But what happens if those children are 5 and 7 years old and something happens to mom and dad at the same time? Who's going to take care of those children? Who should be the guardian for those children? And what about the assets that they inherit? Mom has a life insurance policy with work. Dad has a big life insurance policy because they're worried about their children, but they're young and they can buy a term policy very cheaply. What do they do to put some structure around that? So we try to have our clients, and everyone should think about where those assets are going to go. If the husband and wife die and their children are 8 and 10 years old, some type of trust structure for those children. And who's going to be the trustee? Who in the family is capable of managing the investments and ensuring that those children are going to have resources for them to go to college on? Who's going to determine what they really need and who's competent and who has the time to do that? And even simple things like directing the life insurance into the estate or into the trust for the children. And what are the ages that those children should begin to receive those assets? Because even if they say, I leave everything to my children, depending upon the state, when those children are 18 or 21 years old, they're going to get their hands on everything that's left to them unless there is a trust or some structure that postpones those ages for the children to receive. So I think you had a great point in the beginning by just talking about planning.
Mm-hmm. And we all know that 18-year-olds and teenagers are very fiscally responsible.
Absolutely. But they'll be driving a great car.
With a boat.
With a boat.
With a boat, yeah. Truck, trailer, and boat. Well, you know, we're sitting on the campus of SIU. We have 14,000-plus students who probably vary in age from 17, I guess, is the beginning for most, up to 21. And certainly the master's and some of the graduate students are in their mid to later 20s. They're on the permanent school plan. But what are the basics? I mean, let's talk for just for a moment, going back to bit. What do they need, you know, in terms of a power of attorney, in terms of healthcare directives? Are those important things for, you know, for the average 20-year-old?
Absolutely. I think that everyone, as part of their estate planning, should have a will or living trust, depending upon where they are in their life. But they should also have a healthcare power of attorney and a property power of attorney. And I think most estate planning attorneys, certainly everyone in our office, when we meet with clients, that is always part of their planning process. A healthcare power of attorney allows you or me to designate someone to make healthcare decisions for us when we can't make them on our own. So if I'm in an automobile accident and I'm in the emergency room unconscious and my wife has my healthcare power of attorney, she can step in and tell the physicians what to do. She might pull the plug. I'm not sure. It depends on the day. But
our previous guest was divorced, so...
Yeah, you're right.
That's the ultimate
no,
divorce.
I think I'm in pretty good graces at the moment. Yeah. So, but that healthcare power of attorney allows someone whom you choose to make that decision. And for most people, it would be their spouse. But if they have three or four children, they get to select the child that may be most appropriate. So they may have a child who is a nurse or a physician. And they may think that's the best one to make that decision rather than based upon age. So even a young person who is in college and maybe they're newly married, maybe they're unmarried, they should think through that process. The other thing that healthcare power of attorney will have in it is it will give the agent, that's what they call the person mm-hmm. with the power, the ability to look at medical records under HIPAA, which is important, talk mm-hmm. about the medical condition with your physician. And thirdly, you can give that individual life support directives. So now the Illinois Power of Attorney for Healthcare essentially has two options that you can pick. And you can modify these any way you want. But one says quality of life is most important to me. If it's determined that the quality of life is such that I won't recover or there's going to be no more quality left, that I want my life not prolonged. The other option is to say staying alive is most important to me, and I want my life prolonged with whatever measures might be appropriate to
by all means necessary.
All means necessary. So, and that's important to think through and to have clients think through that process. I also suggest that my clients give their family some direction beyond that piece of paper, because that's a legal document that lets my wife tell the doctors or the hospital, pull the plug. But for many people, that's a hard decision, you know, to pull the plug on your parent or your spouse or your child. So sitting down and talking with your family, and not just the agent, but with your children or your spouse, and saying, this is what I really want, or writing a letter to them saying, I've given you this power and this is what I want you to do with it. It's almost like giving them absolution. You're trying to relieve them of the guilt mm-hmm. of pulling the plug on mom or dad or a child and letting them know that this is okay. It's really what you want to have happen in your life.
The what if factor, you know, what if I did this or what if I did that? Right. Take that out of their hands and absolve them of that guilt and say, look, this is what I wanted. These were my wishes. And you don't have to make that decision.
It's a terrible decision to make for many people. Right. And there are countless families that stand in the hallways of hospitals debating what to do about mom or what to do about dad or what to do about a child. And just some direction to your family can make a tremendous difference in how they understand what you want and why they have some absolution from the guilt of terminating your life.
Well, Larry, as we've talked about many times, any decision based on emotion financially is probably going to be wrong. And we're hitting on another subject today that really gets to that point where you don't want to be making these decisions when you're emotional. You want to, if you have it all planned out, you know, getting back to the planning, as you both talked about, if you have all planned out ahead of time, you don't have to worry about that.
Well, the planning is a big part, but that type of emotional decision, even though you've designated your agent, whether it's a spouse or child or sibling, whoever it happens to be, that can create a lot of distress among the other family members if they haven't talked about it, if they're not aware that that power has been given to one individual. And I've seen it, you know, break families apart because someone was given that authority and designated to make the decision based on the individual's own will, their own desires, and made the decision, and then they're held accountable for the rest of their lives, basically. So it's a very important part. So what would you say, Pat, if for a newly married couple, is the spouse, since our laws of marriage have become more complicated by decisions made in the last few years, is the spouse the automatically designated to have health care power for their spouse in the event they go in the hospital? Do they have that power without the health care directive?
Yes, Illinois gives by law an ordering to make some health care decisions, but not all. It's not nearly expansive in the statute as it is in a health care power of attorney. So, and for somebody who has a limited budget, you can go on the Illinois Secretary of State's website and see a form there for a health care power of attorney and also for a property power of attorney. And a property power allows your agent to manage your financial affairs if you're unable to do so. And that ranges from being able to write checks on your checking account to deal with your 401k, to deal with the Social Security Administration on disability benefits. So I think that's critical as well in people's planning. It's the life planning as well as the death planning. Most attorneys' powers of attorney will follow that format to some extent with broader designations, but it's still important to have something. And if you have a limited budget and go to the website, at least you have something to put in place.
Is it not true that for children, once they reach the age of majority, which I believe in Illinois is 18 years old, then the parents no longer have a right to be involved in making their medical decisions or have access to, under HIPAA, to their medical records without that power of attorney?
That's right. That's right.
I mean, we did have, and I've related this story many times, it's been 10, 15 years ago, but I had a client from Illinois, and their daughter went to school in Florida at age 18 and became ill and was admitted to the hospital. And the parents received a phone call from the hospital basically saying, you need to come down here. And they could and would not release any additional health information regarding the daughter without them going to a judge and getting an attorney down in Florida and getting a healthcare directive from the judge that they could have authority to deal with that situation. So a lot of parents don't realize, yeah, the kids are going away to college and they need their books and they need, you know, a place to stay and et cetera. But without a healthcare power of attorney, if something happens, the parents are going to have to go to court to get authority to act, even though it is their child.
That's right. They will have to be appointed as a guardian for that individual because they're an adult in order to make decisions on their behalf regarding their person. And just like the health care and property powers of attorney, Illinois has both guardians of the person and guardians of the estate, which means the personal decisions and the financial decisions. So, but that's a cumbersome process as opposed to signing a piece of paper and being able to walk into the hospital or into the bank and deal with that person's individual or financial affairs. So,
do you find that some banks, some institutions are I hate to say it, but unfamiliar with someone coming in with those pieces of paper for durable power of attorneys and what to do with them?
Yes, yeah, sometimes it takes an education process. And usually when they get upstream with the branch manager, or they will call their local attorney and get the answer. But we do run into that where the people who are maybe at the, you know, at the
front line,
lower level, the front line, and dealing with someone who walks in with the power of attorney are just very reluctant to deal with it. And that's not their job, frankly. I mean, they're not trained to deal with the legal issues. We just had that in closing an account where the teller told the woman, well, just bring in the will and we'll give you the money to the husband. Well, it doesn't work that way in Illinois. You have to have an affidavit and a death certificate and the will. So when they went back, they got a different teller who knew a little more, and they had to start the process over again. So it's, yes, it is difficult sometimes.
Well, it's well worth the time and the money to make sure that the individual, the family member, is well advised, whether they have children or not, to get the durable power of attorney for durable goods and the one for health care, particularly because of the situation I just cited of kids going away to college or even camp, where they're going to a church camp or scout camp or whatever, whatever type of Olympic training camp. I don't know why that popped in my head, but it did. And, that they, without that healthcare directive, they really don't have any authority to act on behalf of that individual. So as basics, get the basic stuff in place. And then, as a couple's buried and they begin to acquire things, stuff, what do you normally advise in terms of holding personal residence? Of course, you always have joint tenants with right of survivorship. In Illinois, you have ownership in the entirety, I believe, is as it's stated. Maybe touch on what are the differences. What do you see in those two areas?
On real estate for residences, we suggest that most of our clients who are married hold the home as tenants by the entirety. Now, that's relatively new in Illinois. Mm-hmm. And the difference between that and joint tenancy is that if a husband and wife hold a home as tenants by the entirety and one of them is sued and has a judgment against them, that creditor cannot force the sale of the house in order to get what is essentially half of the proceeds of the sale. A joint tenancy, which is the more traditional way that a husband and wife would own a home, did not give that level of protection so that the creditor could attempt to seize half of the value of the house. Either of those titlings work the same way at the death of either the husband or the wife. The home passes to the surviving spouse without going through probate. Most of our clients, frankly, have their homes in tenants by the entirety. Or if they're older, they may still have it in joint tenancy. But most couples that I encounter anticipate their home passing to the surviving spouse at the death of the first. Now, there are some exceptions to that for estate planning purposes or sometimes for liability planning purposes for professionals who may have liability exposure and do not want that house to pass to them if their spouse dies. So they may be titled to one spouse or the other or into a living trust, but probably the majority of people own their residence as joint tenants or tenants by the entirety.
Yeah, makes sense.
It's very simple, and I think for most people, it's the most comfortable structure for them. They want to know that if their husband or their wife dies, that home is theirs. Whether they still have a mortgage or not, they want to know that home is theirs and it's not tied up in a trust. Whether it's there for them or not, there's just a comfort level with knowing that house is in their name. And if they want to sell it and buy something smaller, they want to sell it and move, there's nobody that impinges upon their ability to do that.
And for a lot of people, that's their largest asset.
That is, particularly young couples. I mean, young couples, they have a home and a mortgage. They may have some savings. They may have a life insurance policy.
We hope.
To protect themselves and their children. Absolutely. And they may have a 401k that they're beginning to build. But that's what most young families have.
That's pretty typical. And in those cases, then a will may suit their needs, particularly if it addresses some of the issues of guardianship. Because if they don't have a will, maybe it's not stated correctly, but I always tell them that even if you don't have one, you really do, because the state of Illinois will tell you how things are going to go if you die and don't have a will in place, as far as who's going to become the guardian of your kids, who's going to take over financial aspects, particularly if both individuals are simultaneously killed in an accident. Correct me if I'm wrong, but then basically you're going to go to court and the court's going to help decide, along with the attorneys, you know, who plays those different roles.
Oh, that's right. And over the years, I'm sure everyone has seen some ugly scenarios when both a husband and a wife are killed in a car accident, or they're divorced and one of them dies and the families are estranged. The issue of guardianship is always left to the courts, but you can designate in your will whom you suggest to be the guardian of your children. And for young couples, I think that's one of the most important decisions. And frankly, takes a husband and wife discussing that in rather difficult conversations, because one spouse may think that their sister is the perfect guardian, and the other spouse thinks that that is a terrible choice. So we've had a number of clients that it's been a slow process to get to the point of filling in that line on their draft, but it forces them to think through the process. They can also suggest or designate alternates if the first designated guardian cannot serve. And in general, the courts will follow those directives. But if your designated guardian happens to become a drug addict or an alcoholic, or is otherwise disabled between the time you wrote your will and the time that you pass away, and that becomes relevant, the court is not going to give your children to someone who is in drug rehabilitation. That's beyond the scope. So that's why it still goes through that guardianship process.
Is it true that you should, or maybe could, designate an alternate individual to handle financial affairs from the individual who's actually going to take over raising the children?
Yes, that is not unusual. And many people think that the rationale behind that is that the person who is raising your children is going to have enough to do without managing the financial aspects of their trust. Most of the time in our planning, even for young couples, we will have a will that will say fairly simply, if I pass away, I leave everything to my spouse. If my spouse is not living, then everything goes to our children, but it goes to our children in a trust. For younger couples, most commonly, that's a single trust for the children, and it will direct the trustee to use the income that's earned on the investments in the trust, or the principal if they need it, to pay for the children's education, perhaps until the youngest child reaches 25 or 26, and then whatever is left, divide up evenly between the children that are there at that time. Kind of the rationale of that is that if the parents were living and one child wanted to go to Harvard and the other one wanted to go to SWCC, that's okay. They would pay whatever they had available to support their children's course of education. And if you divide everything up, when the parents die and the two children are 10 and 12 years old, one child might go to SWCC and inherit a big lump of money at 26, whereas the other child goes to Harvard and has nothing left, or doesn't even have enough money to get through school. So by having that single trust, it's much more like what a couple would have. And at some point, their children are hopefully at the end of their education, and what's left is then their inheritance, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But to circle back to your question, in many cases, the guardian is raising not only the deceased couple's children, but also their own children. So their life is busy. And to have someone else managing the investment side and the expense side kind of separates those responsibilities. And in many cases, we have clients who will have a family member as the trustee. It doesn't need to be a corporate trustee like a bank or a trust company or investment firm. But in other cases, we will have clients who will have a family member and a corporate trustee like a bank or a trust company to manage the investments. And part of the thinking there is that the professional trustee has the experience and the time and the focus to ensure that the investments are handled correctly, hopefully, while the family member brings a sense of awareness of the children and their needs to the trust so that it's not just some person working their job getting a call from the guardian saying, you know, we need some money for Johnny's clothes for school this fall. The family member trustee is sitting down with the corporate trustee and saying, yeah, this is what they really need, and this is appropriate for those children.
Provides a check and balance.
Exactly, exactly. And it doesn't have to, you don't have to have a corporate trustee, an individual family member. If I designate my brother-in-law as a trustee for my children's trust, my brother-in-law can hire an investment firm to manage those investments just like I would myself. So it's not necessary to have a corporate trustee, but in some cases it makes it much more balanced and takes away some of the responsibility.
Well, I find a corporate trustee is a good choice. Not only does it take the emotion out of the situation, and to some extent maybe more than it should be, but more likely in a very complicated type of situation, a state where maybe, you know, there's a farm that's in the estate. There's a business that is now in the estate that needs to be run or sold, or land involved, maybe in multiple states. So you're dealing with a situation where the corporate trustee hopefully has the experience in dealing with a variety of different situations and different assets, as opposed to the proceeds of a life insurance policy. You know, here's $500,000 for the health, welfare, and benefit of the children. You know, well, now there are other, you know, we've got a herd of 500 cattle that have to be dealt with, right. You know, and fed and so forth and so on. So, yeah, we do find that can be a situation. I know personally of a family situation where an individual was a brother of the deceased, and he was put in charge of the trust for the three children. And he did his job. He did it very well. He did it to the best of his ability, but he was not happy about being in that situation. The children were a little bit, shall we say, different, and liked to waste money. And it was a challenge getting the phone calls that, oh, I need money for this, I need money for that. You know, he would rather have not been in that role, but he was, and he carried out his duties and I think did a great job. But so getting back to the will, there's another issue that I find often in those types of situations is a spendthrift clause. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. And I want to make just one comment on trustees. Many people designate a family member because they are concerned about the corporate trustee fees. But I think you made a good point, Larry. People don't realize what responsibility goes with that job. If a trustee is doing their job correctly, they are managing the investment portfolio. And obviously, markets are volatile, and many individuals are not capable of doing that. Even if they hire someone, they're still responsible for managing the oversight of that investment portfolio. They're charged with paying the expenses and making decisions as to when the beneficiaries are entitled to distributions from the trust. They're charged with having tax returns prepared and keeping an accounting. And in the end, every one of those beneficiaries has the opportunity to sue them if they don't do their job right. Mm-hmm. So be careful what you wish for. And I
exactly.
think there are benefits to paying for those responsibilities being shifted away. And I think that people who designate a family member should have that conversation with them, and the family members should clearly understand
what responsibility
they have.
Know what they're getting into. Because some of the corporate trustees I'm familiar with that are available in our area, the fees up to $1 million state are 0.5%.
Yes.
I mean, and that's on the low end, certainly. But for that, I think it's well worth.
the responsibility is really much more than people realize. And we see lots of trustees who are jammed up or sued because of the way they handled their job. Mm-hmm. And that's no fun.
I mean, you're basically signing the dotted line. You're going to be the bad guy.
You're a fiduciary.
Right.
And going back to our favorite.
Someone's coming and asking you for money, and it's not a valid mm-hmm. reason. You're the bad guy. You're the one that has to say no. And if you're a family member, that can cause issues.
That is true.
So back to the spendthrift clause.
Yes, sorry.
That's okay.
A spendthrift clause is a clause that is in a trust. And what it essentially says is that the beneficiary cannot pledge their trust interest and that creditors cannot reach in and grab a beneficiary's trust assets. And that is done to protect the beneficiary essentially from themselves and their creditors. And those are common in virtually every trust that we see, whether we draft it or somebody else. The spendthrift clause has been recognized for a long time in trust law, and it's a common clause to try to protect beneficiaries. There's certain creditors that can get beyond those spendthrift clauses. The IRS is one.
Certainly.
What a surprise.
Yeah.
Didn't see that coming.
In certain circumstances. So, but they are really designed to protect your beneficiaries from squandering their trust or having it exposed because they have a financial life that exposes them. So,
well, and again, real life example, a very good friend of mine I went to college with, his father owned a business, was pretty well off, and had set up a trust, and unfortunately didn't have a spendthrift clause, and there were three brothers and three sisters, I believe, so, you know, six children. And when the father passed away, much too young, the one son, most of them did okay, but the one son, as soon as he hit 18 and got his share, which was several hundred thousand dollars, went out and bought the biggest boat he could find, literally. And, of course, that was fun for a summer or two, and at that point he was boatless and broke. And, you know, going to the other family members saying, oh, but, you know, would you share? And, you know, had they had a spendthrift clause and said, okay, you get, 20% at age 21 and 10% more, so forth, at 25 or 30 and so forth, then that would not have happened. But unfortunately, that was not a part
of it. The great thing about trust is you kind of have hands from the grave, if you will.
You do.
And putting those provisions in that you get a certain amount at this age, a certain amount when you're a little bit older, and you hope, you know, your fingers are crossed that as they get older, they become more responsible. And that's the goal with structuring them that way. Doesn't always happen, but that's the intention of the purpose, and it makes it much easier to do that.
It does. And many people are, most people, I think, who adopt a trust for their children will follow that structure, John. They will stage it out over what they anticipate the ages are that their children might grow into being financially responsible. And we have some clients who come back as their children get older and keep moving the ages back because obviously the children aren't progressing quite as quickly as they want.
Yeah, well.
The other thing we see is parents who are concerned about, I mean, there are a number of reasons for staging those ages. One is maturity or financial maturity. We always say they might blow the first third, but maybe by the time they get to inheriting the second or the last part of their trust, they've figured out how to manage money a little bit better. We have people who are concerned about their children's marriages. And divorce. And they will set those trusts up for their children to be dispersed at very late ages, maybe 50 or 60 or later, because they are concerned that their children, while they may have the income and access to the principal, and the children may even be their own trustee, they're concerned that if they receive that money, that it will become part of their marital property. And if they get a divorce, that their daughter-in-law or son-in-law may ultimately end up taking what was the parents' property, and they really intended to go to their children and grandchildren. So they're focused on insulating those inherited assets from a potential divorce.
To the best of their ability, and I know I have clients who we've advised to seek counsel for that, because you have a lot of blended families today. It's just fact of the matter that there's a first marriage with some children, a second marriage with some children, maybe a third with some children, and you know they each of them have the right and the interest in sharing what they have accumulated and they've gained over their lifetime with the children that they want to. And if it's not properly designated, then it's a very simple process that if the new spouse gets it, that it may end up going somewhere they don't want it to.
That's right.
And that, you know, leads us back to designations. And this is as basic as life insurance policies, annuities. Another good example in terms of designating the beneficiary is the contract written normally, the contract language, as the beneficiary designated in a situation that is per stirpes, or whether it is actually per capita, because it's different. I don't know if you touch on those.
Sure. Per stirpes, if you have a contract, for instance, that says that at my death, this benefit, whether it's an annuity or life insurance or otherwise, is payable to my children, or my descendants, normally, per stirpes, what that means is that the benefit, whatever it might be, is divided at the first generation where there is somebody living. So if I have four children and I leave my annuity to my beneficiaries per stirpes, what that means is that if all four children are living, each one gets a fourth. If one of them is deceased, then that child's share would pass to his or her descendants. So there would still be four pieces. Mm-hmm. But for my deceased daughter, her one-fourth might be divided between her two children. So per stirpes divides at that first level. Per capita means it's divided among the number of people who are there regardless of generations. So in that scenario, instead of it being divided in quarters, it may be divided in sixths because there are six beneficiaries within the mm-hmm. within the pool of descendants, let's say. So it's very important to understand what those mean. It's also very important to look at those contracts, whether they be life insurance or annuities or 401k plans or IRAs, as to what happens with the beneficiary designations and what happens if that first beneficiary is not living. So, for instance, you have a life insurance policy that's payable to your spouse, and if you don't have a spouse living, then to your estate. That if you and your spouse were killed in an automobile accident, the assets may pass into your estate, but if you hit a school bus as part of your death, the claims against your estate may be substantial. If that life insurance is payable to your children or payable to a trust for your children, it may be insulated from those claims against your estate, whereas if the money comes into the probate estate mm-hmm. itself, it may be fully exposed to a claim by creditors who file suit against the estate. So understanding that process, or even in a non-liability situation, if the policy says that it's payable to your spouse, and if you don't have a spouse, then to your descendants per stirpes, and your children are 16 and 17 years old, you may have a trust in your will, but the policy benefits may go to those children. And even though they're minors at 16 and 17, when they turn 18, they may get their full share of that $1 million mm-hmm. life insurance policy. So you think you have a structure that put everything in trust for your kids until they're 40, and Johnny's driving a new Corvette when he turns 18 because he just got his hands on $500,000. So that's what we started talking about in the beginning, is the planning aspect mm-hmm. of estate planning. And it really is much more than just having a piece of paper that says will on the top of it.
Well, you have to know. And I find this with so many clients. And John and I will speak for John in this case. John and I are not attorneys. We're not attorneys. We don't give legal advice. However, we have seen enough situations with clients that we can at least understand that there may be questions that they need to seek, you know, proper legal counsel related to that. Because if they don't understand, and I'm thinking even a fund company, most of the fund companies that are out there today, I don't care if it's Vanguard or American Funds or who it is, Fidelity, if you actually read the documents that set up the account, most of them now specify when you designate a beneficiary whether the standard contract is per stirpes or per capita. And if you don't know what that means, or if your agent or whoever you're dealing with doesn't know what that means, then I'd probably look for a new agent. But besides that, you need to understand that if you name an individual, do you want it going to split between your children, or do you want it going to your children's children, as it may, you know, in certain situations. And every contract, every company is different. There is no rhyme or reason, if you will, and same on life insurance. The base policy gives you a primary beneficiary, oftentimes a contingent beneficiary, but it also specifies, unless you designate otherwise, whether it stops with them or if it does go down to their decedents, you know, in the event that they precease the death benefit. So you have to understand how things play through, and it's not simple. It's a very complicated process.
It is a process. And I know that on the internet there are lots of forms out there for wills and powers of attorney. But just as you were saying, Larry, what looks like a great form to a layperson may not accomplish their goals at all. And doing it right and spending a little money to do it right will accomplish what you really intend to do. Doing it wrong will just create, in many cases, a fiasco for your heirs and your family when you pass away.
Yeah, there's nothing worse than being in that situation, unfortunate, as we're talking about this month, an unexpected and unfortunate event occurs, someone dies, and what you think was going to happen, you're informed by counsel that that is not what the documents say, and it's too late. I mean, in most situations, I want to make that statement, it's too late to do anything about it.
No, we just had an estate where it was clear that the husband planned for one scenario and protecting his family from the scenario that he anticipated, and that was not for him to die first. And unfortunately, he died young, and so all of his, what I would say, lifetime planning, the way he had structured his ownership of various properties with partners and things like that, was prematurely brought to a head. And unfortunately, it's created a fiasco, and he died without a will. So it is under state law, as you were alluding to earlier.
Wow.
His wife is getting half, his children are getting half. Clearly not his intention, no trust for these minor children. So what he had thought was an organized structure blew up when he accidentally passed away prematurely, at least prematurely according to his planning. So it's very important to think through not just what you're doing today, but how those pieces will come together when you do die.
And particularly the blending of families where two people are married and, you know, they're forming one union, one financial entity. They really need to take a look at what's going on, particularly if, you know, one of the individuals maybe comes from a wealthy family and by whatever, however you want to define that, and the other individual doesn't, then the melding, the merging of those two financial situations is really important to get a handle on, because it can have serious impacts for years and decades, really, down the road to come. So we're basically, as we're kind of wrapping things up here, we got 5 minutes or so to take this topic to
we
a close.
We will have to have Pat come back, because we didn't touch on several,
so many
several things on the list that I wanted to go through.
So many things.
Well, I think have another month of the unexpected.
The basics are, if I can try and do a little recap, is the basics are plan. You know, put a plan in place, whether it's a financial plan, it's a life plan for your estate, for your beneficiaries. You know, the healthcare directive, the power of attorney for healthcare and durable goods. And in my opinion, everybody needs to have those. You know, I have them for my daughter. She has mine. My wife has ours. So everybody's got a copy of those directives to take care of that situation as they grow. The basic will certainly is something that should be addressed. I can't tell you how many clients come in and I talk to them about it. And they're, oh yeah, we planned on doing that and just never got around to it. Well, you know, those round to it sometimes come back and bite us when somebody dies prematurely, and then it's too late. So. Planning, you know, and Pat, I have to tell you, my wife was talking to a coworker of hers yesterday at school at SWCC. She works down in, as an adjunct professor at SWCC, and they were discussing the show, and the coworker had lost her husband a couple of months ago, and just indicated that they had worked with your firm, with you in particular, and in putting their documents and things in place, and had high praise. Unsolicited high praise that, you know, it was a smooth process. It was well thought out, and things turned out exactly as they had hoped in that situation, as difficult as it was. So our thanks to you.
Well, I appreciate that comment, and I appreciate that lady's comment as well, Larry. Thank you.
Absolutely. We'll pass it on. Hopefully she'll be listening to the show when it comes up here shortly. So,
well, in our practice, estate planning is kind of the gratifying area of the practice, because we can help people, and generally it's not contentious because it's not like the litigation and some of the other business disputes that we deal with, and for the most part, I think clients, when they understand the process and they understand what they're doing and why they're doing it, are appreciative, and so it's a gratifying area of the practice, and we feel like we're helping people to plan for themselves and their children and their families, and so there's much benefit, not just for clients, but for us as well, mm-hmm. in that area.
Pat, if somebody has a question, I'm assuming, again, maybe that's difficult, but that if someone has questions they want to ask you, who should they contact? And that you would probably sit down with them initially just to, at no cost, to see what their needs are and point them in the right direction.
They can call me. I mean, we have an office in Belleville, and we have an office in Edwardsville both, mm-hmm. and we have an office in Clayton as well. They can certainly call and talk with me, and I'm happy to ask questions. We send out an information sheet before we meet with clients, and generally we'll sit down and talk a bit. We don't do mass free consultations because, frankly, we would be overwhelmed with non-revenue generating time. But that doesn't mean we don't talk to people on the phone and mm-hmm. and kind of give them a background and come in and have a conversation with them. And most of the people who come in and meet with us, frankly, we do their work. I mean, I think we have a good working background. We have some very knowledgeable attorneys. I think we have a good reputation. And so we have very few clients who will come in and do a consultation mm-hmm. and say, I don't want to do this. So it's just the beginning of the process.
Yeah. And what's the phone number that they could reach you at?
The best number for me is 618-234-9800. 234-9800. They can ask for me, and if I'm not available, my assistant's name is Shelby, and she can certainly coordinate a time to meet or talk and get information out to them. And if I'm not available because I'm out of town, we mm-hmm. certainly have other attorneys who work in this area who are very qualified, and we cover for each other all of the time.
So. And then the website, if someone wanted to go out and look up your firm on the internet and learn a little bit more?
Yes, they can just put in the firm name, Mathis Marifian, M-A-R-I-F-I-A-N, and Richter, R-I-C-H-T-E-R, Limited, and it's www.mmrltd.com.
Very good.
Perfect. Pat, thanks for joining us. It's been very informative.
Went by way too fast.
Hopefully helpful to our listeners as to some of the basics that they may or may not have taken care of, but they really need to. This is important stuff. They need to part of the planning process that we talk about every week on the show.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate the opportunity, and it's great to see both of you. And I kind of like talking about this topic, too.
Absolutely. We'll have you back. We'll have some more discussions in this area. So, John, what's our discussion, our story for the week?
Mine, have you heard where the dog ate my homework? And actually, it did happen to one of my children. One of our dogs did eat
Murphy would eat anything, so
Murphy
I believe it.
Murphy would eat anything. Yeah. Well, this one, and it's always Florida. I don't understand, but Florida man claims a dog accidentally shot his girlfriend.
Okay.
So
I'll bite.
Diesel. Well played. Well played.
Thank you.
So the Jacksonville man was shot in the leg while she was sleeping. And he said that he got up and went outside. And when he came back in, the gun went off. And he suspected that the dog jumped up on the table where the gun or the dog jumped on the table where the gun was, and that's how the gun went off. And as of the date of this article, no charges have been filed yet, but wow, that's really that's pushing the dog ate my homework story.
Yeah, that is kind of making although with Murphy I could anyway. It's kind of a long, I don't know if it's really along those lines or not, but I found another one. These are kind of our silly crazy criminal stories, Pat, and there was an individual, and he gives their name, I won't, who was impersonating a police officer, and he pulled over another car for speeding, and the driver quickly figured out that the person who had just pulled him over was not a cop, because the guy he pulled over was a cop.
Was a cop.
And periodically he did arrest him, and he went to jail for impersonating an officer. So
wow.
You picked the wrong guy to pull over.
So folks, if you go out to our website, www.thefinancialcafe.us, go ahead and vote for Larry's story or my story. And we will hand out a free t-shirt based on who wins. And then we'll pick a name from that group. And again, we want to thank the Chef Shop and WSIE and Steve and everyone else here for allowing us this opportunity to bring you this information and have some fun in the process.
We always have fun in the process, John.
Absolutely.
All right, we'll wrap things up. Say goodbye, John.
Goodbye, John.
You've been listening to The Financial Cafe, airing every Saturday at 9 a.m. on 88.7 WSIE The Sound. Today's show is underwritten by The Chef Shop in Edwardsville, your hometown kitchen accessory store, where a good cup of coffee starts every day right. Listeners are invited to send your questions regarding retirement, investments, or any other financial topic that may pique your interest. Send the questions to John at jgraney@nickelfinancial.com or to Larry at lexo@nickelfinancial.com. John and Larry will discuss those questions each week during their Q&A session. If you prefer, they will respond to you in private. Thanks for listening to The Financial Cafe on 88.7 WSIE The Sound.